I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is John B. Wallace. He's a retired public land manager for the city of Carbondale at Cedar Lake and an environmental educator at Southern Illinois University's Touch of Nature Environmental Center. He's a founding member and president of the Shawnee chapter of the Illinois Audubon Society and a founding member of Shawnee Forest Defense and Shawnee Park and Climate Alliance. He's been a forest activist working to protect the Shawnee National Forest in Southern Illinois more than three decades. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being on the program.
Derek, thank you for having me. Proud to be here.
So can we start by just introducing people who might not live in the region to what the region's biomes are? What's its history? What was it like especially prior to conquest? What are some of the defining features? Like, what are the rivers? What are the, et cetera?
Sure. Well, first off, I want to geographically make people understand where we're located. We're in the southern tip of Illinois. Illinois is a long vertical state as a rule, and down here, where the Shawnee National Forest spans, comes to a triangular point in a bit. Bordered on the west side primarily by the Mississippi River and bordered on the east and south side by the Ohio River. And the confluence of the Ohio River and the Mississippi meet at the southern tip in a city called Cairo, located in southern Illinois. There's been many different descriptions of European settlers that first set foot in this area, and some of them talk about how dark and haunting the forests were until you would reach one of the floodplains of the river or go out onto the bluffs where you can actually see the floodplain of one of those great rivers. So it was. It's primarily a deciduous forest dominated by oak, hickory, maple, and beech trees. We have an incredible amount of diversity of both ecotypes as well as just different tree species. For instance, we have 19 species of oaks that dominate our forest here. Six maple, nine hickory, as well as a host of many others. But I want to point out too that people tend to think of Illinois as a very either as Chicago and the surrounding area or primarily very flat state. Dominated by the soybean and corn desert, as I often call it. And one of the reasons Illinois is so flat and has so many farm fields in it is because of several different glacier advances that came down from the north, and one, the Illinois Glacier, stopped right at the northern edge of the Shawnee. And all that glacial till created what became the prairies prior to the European settlement, and are now predominantly almost all agricultural lands. In the Shawnee National Forest area, however, that southern tip of Illinois, and we're farther south than the majority of Kentucky. To kind of put it in perspective, Kentucky has a big hump, that comes up around southern Illinois and then reaches into Indiana and Ohio with the Ohio River. We're a relatively southern region, but we're also very centrally located. those glaciers that I talked about earlier brought many different unique species down with them, and kind of dropped them in the in what is called the Shawnee Hills. We have right in this little region of southern Illinois, we have five physiographic areas that converge all at once. The southern glacial till plain, which I described, that's the furthest extent of the Illinoisan glacier, is the one that kind of borders, really defines what makes this area more forested and less prairie than the rest of the state. The southern till plain borders the northern edge of the Shawnee region. Just to the south of that, predominantly is the Shawnee Hills region, dominated by sandstone bluffs, outcroppings. It's a very hilly terrain here that borders on the west side of Illinois with the Ozark Highlands. So the same Ozark Mountains that are found in Missouri and Arkansas actually reach over into the western part of southern Illinois. And then to the south of both the Ozark Highlands and the Shawnee Hills is an area that's called the Coastal Plain, which is swamps, typical swamps that are more typically found in Louisiana and Georgia and Florida, cypress, Tupelo swamps. And this is the furthest northern extension that you'll find some of the cypress swamps. And back before the continents shifted so much and ocean levels changed so drastically, that part of southern Illinois was the Gulf of Mexico. And so, you know, that has receded, but we have some of the oldest swamps in the nation. But it's all in a relatively small region. And one of the most significant components of that region is the fact that we have a lot of public land. We have several different wildlife refuges: the Cypress Creek National Wildlife Refuge, Crab Orchard National Wildlife Refuge. But we also have the Shawnee National Forest, which is an area of over 290,000 acres that spans, again, from the Mississippi River on the west to the Ohio River on the east. The different communities range from very dry xeric sandstone and limestone glades. So I didn't mention that the Ozark Highlands are dominated by limestone substrate, whereas the Shawnee Hills are sandstones substrate. So we have both these hot, dry glades that tend to be the rock tops of the bluff top areas, and what expand out from them are some barrens, some drier barrens. They go to upland oak, hickory forests, and then because of all the hills and valleys, there are many different more moister climes. There are the different mesophytic type forests that are more dominated by maple and beech and liriodendron, tulip poplar or tulip tree, and you know, down to floodplain forests and then those southern swamps where we have the cypress and tupelo. So there's many different types of plant communities, and those plant communities are defined more by their geographic location and their moisture levels, that are a lot are brought on by the geologic substrate. And then we also are in a relatively moist area. We get around 50 inches a year in rainfall And so that just is a small glimpse. We have different types of springs. We have some calcareous seep springs, as well as just a deeper springs. A few Ozark streams on the western expanse, and as well as spring-fed Shawnee Hills streams of high quality across southern Illinois. The different organisms that inhabit this area, besides the different plants, we have a cinnamon fern in a couple of rare areas, in one of these calcareous seeps that are more often found in places like Minnesota and Wisconsin. But again, that's believed that those remnants, and they're down in these steep valleys that are cool and moist, so they thrive. But it's believed that the glaciers brought those different plant communities down into the area. And plus, we have these hill prairies also that are associated with some of those open glade communities, and then we have these deep, lush, deciduous forests. And so there's many different types of animals that inhabit these different regions. We have a more southern salamander. It's called the dusky spotted salamander, but it only occurs in one county in southern Illinois. We have a number of different, especially herp species, timber rattlesnakes, that are very are struggling because they don't have a great ability to readily replenish their numbers. Their reproductive systems are rather they don't readily reproduce that easily, and they are very territorial. And when their habitat is disrupted, they're pretty much if say their hibernacula is destroyed, and timber rattlesnakes are part of the pit viper group of organisms that the they give live birth. It's called ovoviviparous. One of the things that makes reptiles is the fact that they're egg bearing. They don't generally give live birth like mammals do. But it's kind of an exception with the ovoviviparous reptiles. They lay their eggs, and as they're laying their eggs hatch, and so. Timber rattlesnakes have birthing rookeries where the females of all different the females come back to give birth in the same place where they were born, if that makes sense. And if those things are disturbed and the habitat is destroyed, the animal can't reproduce. It just does not do it. The same with its hibernacula, which tend to be in rocky areas. We have a road in the Shawnee that's called Snake Road. It's a 2.5 mile gravel road that twice a year is closed to vehicular traffic for 60 days in the spring and in the fall for reptilian migration. And it is located in LaRue Pine Hills, an ecological area, and it is there are limestone bluffs next to a wetland, a swamp wetland, and the snakes primarily, a number of different frogs and lizards also, but the snakes hibernate in the rocky bluffs in the winter and then go to the swamps to during their season to reproduce and whatnot, and then go back up into the limestone bluffs. And so, it again, just it's important for those animals to have that, have the place where they reproduce as well as where they hibernate, protected. And so that's a little bit about the area back before settlement. Again, before a European settlement, I should say. We had woodland bison and elk that are no longer here anymore, as well as mountain lion, red wolves, and black bear. The red wolves are gone. Every now and then we have a sighting of black bear, and more we're having reports, and even the Illinois Department of Natural Resources are actually admitting that we do have a mountain lions do inhabit the area, but they're not sustainable at this point. You know, it seems to be more than anything males expanding their range, but that's, you know, our primary dominant mammals right now. Apex are probably bobcats and coyotes, but that's a little bit of background. I hope that helps.
No, that's great. That's great. I've got so many questions. Just very briefly, can you talk about, and you mentioned this, but can you talk just a tiny bit more about the sort of ecological magic that happens at the, where you have so many different ecotypes in one place, that, you know, like here, where I live is primarily redwood forest, and the redwood forest is pretty expansive, and it's also fairly, I don't want to say uniform, but you get what I'm getting at. And then if you move up east into the mountains, there's like a place called the Klamath Knot. And the reason it's called that is because all these different ecotypes converge in that spot, which creates some magic. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yes.
Can you talk just briefly about the magic that occurs at these interfaces?
You know, it's there is a lot of magic. I have a hard time, you know, just picking out a simple example of it. But again, we've got these. We have northern species that are at the farthest southern reaches of their extent. We have eastern species that reach the farthest west here in the Shawnee. Western species that reach the farthest east in the Shawnee, and then southern that reach up the farthest north. And that is again because of our centrally our unique location geographically, our geologic makeup, and then the different lay of the land. You know, it's amazing to have literally within probably 200 yards of space, because of, by having a bluff overlooking a wetland, a swampy area, a dry bluff top, you know, where we have these different insects like the lichen grasshopper, which is a grasshopper that looks, you know, it's marked exactly like lichen, except it moves, you know, and quite freely. But it blends in so well with the sandstone surroundings that it's the predators have a hard time, finding it. We have such things like that. I'm trying to think of another example. We have several different tree frogs. We have what's called a bird voice tree frog that, it's amazing. We in early June in the swamps. It's almost deafening. The different sounds that we have, gray tree frogs and green tree frogs. And then when it's either recently rained, it's about to rain in the same floodplain forest. So many of the swamps if you want to go experience them, you'll take a walk through a floodplain forest. But then if you're there right before a rain, these bird voice tree frogs start up. So we've got these rather annoying gray tree frogs are very, very common. Just a loud kind of a nasally grunt, I guess, would be the way to describe their calls. And they're comprising most of the sounds that you're hearing, besides every now and then some bird songs. But then to all of a sudden have these bird voice tree frogs that actually sound very bird-like, a whistle, but very regular, unlike most birds. You know, it's a more rigid, and then they pitch in on the chorus. It's really fascinating. In the same place we have cottonmouth snakes that more than anything are just happy by laying in a sunny spot on a path, where some sun hits the ground, and just coil up. And as you approach, they just sit there in their coil and just open their mouths wide open to see that white cottony, the interior of their mouths. And it's quite effective at making one go out of their way around that snake. And of course it is it's also a venomous snake. So you definitely don't want to get bit by a cottonmouth, but far from anything, far from being aggressive. So that's just a walk to one of the one of our swamp areas. Another bit of magic is in the spring when the waterfalls are flowing. We have so many different waterfalls. It just is it's so incredible how the different sounds and how the plant and animal life just really is so prominent when the creeks, the streams, the waterfalls are all flowing. We have the different liverworts that are these real simple plants that are not flowering plants. They're more closely related to mosses and ferns, and they tend to grow on under waterfalls and very moist areas, cool moist areas, and then you go up on top of the bluff, the same bluff that is creating these waterfalls. You go up on top of the bluff and find a place away from the stream, and you can find a prickly pear cactus and agave blooming. It's that much drier and hotter, yet we have these other very moisture loving plants found in down below in the valleys and whatnot. Does that help?
Oh yeah, that's great. That makes me very happy to hear. So my next question before we move on is, what have been? It's pretty striking when you say that the apex predator, striking to me at least, that when you say the apex predators are bobcats and coyotes, that what has been the, and also you said the elk and buffalo are gone. What have been some of the ramifications of losing megafauna?
You know, it's it it You know, I wish I knew all of the components that were missing and knew all the different roles that they played, but I'm afraid I don't. I have to guess, you know, and we have to try to extrapolate. We are struggling with and have been with different management practices that are recommended. One of them, the most highly, besides just timber cutting, but the most commonly used practices is this prescribed fire to try to, quote, restore some of the natural processes to the forest. And not that fire did not influence some of the plant and animal communities on the Shawnee, but it certainly hasn't. It's not appropriate everywhere, and it's such a heavy use. These are not fire dependent ecosystems for the most part. Again, some of these hot, drier areas that I described, clearly lightning would strike those areas periodically, and drought and fire would happen, but not down into the moister regions. But in order to try, and the land managers just keep trying keeps trying to restore or establish different components back to the landscape, and unfortunately they failed greatly. But what I think is really missing, especially with the no longer having the woodland bison or the elk, the impact from these large ungulates that would drastically affect the vegetation in an area. We no longer have that. We have white-tailed deer, and we have quite a hefty population of white-tailed deer, but I don't think it was anything like the bison that once came through the region, or the elk. And I think that in trying to restore some of these communities, that land managers are relying too heavily on fire, for instance. So, it's just amazing when we've lost several different insect species in some of these barrens and some of these glade communities due to managers using excessive use of fire. And not that fire didn't play a role, but especially some of the different lepidopteran species, the butterflies and moths that actually pupate in leaf litter. When that leaf litter is burned, and if they're burned thoroughly and repetitively, you will kill all of the all of those insects, and that has shown up in a number of different natural areas within the Shawnee. So we're missing that, and then I mentioned the white-tailed deer. You know, it's now we seem to have white-tailed deer are more plentiful than probably have been documented since European settlement. Their numbers may be out of whack, and I think probably eliminating some of those apex predators played a key role in that factor. I actually was a land manager of some public land prior to retirement, and one day I was working on a piece of equipment, and I heard this strange sound, and I didn't realize what it was because the diesel motor was running, And I looked up, and a doe and a fawn came out of the woods, and on the fawn was on one side of the doe, and a bobcat was on the other side. And they were walking actually in a lawn area, and the doe was just snorting. What I heard was the doe snorting, trying to scare the bobcat off that was hoping to snag that little fawn. But I don't think it ever succeeded. That doe was pretty being pretty defensive of her fawn. But you know, quite possibly, if we had some of these larger predators and more aggressive predators, the deer population would be kept down. One of the big problems we also have that people that are facing are at least we, you know, wildlife faces it as well. There's no question, but we really have a high tick population, and I can't help but think that it's related to the high deer population, the high mammal population here, and possibly having some more of those apex predators might, you know, to keep these the population in check might have had a better impact on, you know, on keeping tick numbers down too. But that's not known science. That's just John's perspective, I guess.
One of the things I'm really loving about this conversation is how much attention you are paying to insects and amphibians and reptiles and those groups of non-humans don't, I think, often get enough attention. And so I really appreciate the fact that you are spending probably 20% of your time talking about them. So thank you for that.
It's, you know, they, without, we can, you know, the world can get by fine without human beings. It really can. But you take insects out of the mix, and ecosystems will collapse. You know, it's just incredible what important components insects are to this, you know, and I mean, I'm sure you've read about the insect Armageddon. You know, we're really facing crises. Some of the most noticeable drop in insect populations is occurring in moth and butterflies, the lepidopterans. And, you know, and then we have in southern Illinois, we have three species of bats that are federally endangered. The Indiana bat, the gray bat, and the northern long-eared bat. And they're all forest dwellers, and they eat moths. Moths and butterfly populations are crashing. I mean, they have many other problems, don't get me wrong. The white nose syndrome is a real problem on bat species in this part of the country. It is devastating them. I mean, they will, researchers will find colonies just completely infected with white nose syndrome. And from what I understand, most of the time, if a colony has white nose syndrome, they won't make it through their hibernation. You know, it's just most of them will die because of this fungus that disturbs them through their hibernation. But we certainly need to have, and we also are bird populations, whippoorwills and chuckwills widows, that are also moth eaters, important moth eaters. You know, their numbers are really drastically dropping right now. You know, these are really important components. You know, without the insects, are, you know, that's pretty much what all our songbirds. I mean, we have 350 species of birds in the Shawnee National Forest. You know, without insects, I mean, there's a few that eat fish, but what do you think those fish eat? they rely on insects. They're, you know, these food webs, the system is broken, And we need to start taking some drastic action to make some repairs to it.
Well, that seems to be a good segue to the next topic. And we have about 10 to 12 minutes left. And can you spend a little bit of time talking about, we've been talking about the region and you've been talking about the Shawnee National Forest. Can you talk about the Shawnee National Park proposal?
Sure. So I have spent the last 34 years of my life fighting the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Forest Service, primarily because of their logging, their resource extractive focus. And
before you go on, I just want to validate that, there's a local Forest Service here that's actually quite good, and the reason they're quite good is because they don't have a timber sale program, and basically timber sale programs destroy everything. I'm just throwing that out. Go ahead.
You know, it's sad to say, but economics always trump other interests. You know, when you have economics associated with resource extraction, it's hard to change that mindset. And the mission of the Forest Service compared to the National Park Service, for instance, is just the difference is significant. For instance, the mission of the USDA Forest Service is to sustain the health, diversity, and productivity, real important word, of the nation's forests and grasslands to meet the needs of present and future generations. In contrast, the mission of the National Park Service is to preserve unimpaired the natural and cultural resources and values of the national park system for the enjoyment, education, and inspiration of this and future generations. The Forest Service doesn't even have nature in its, you know, there's nothing natural in its mission. And it's not their fault necessarily. You know, it is unfortunately an agency that has much more of a mandate on productivity than it does on maintaining the integrity, the natural integrity. And so I have been fighting the Forest Service. We've done litigation, we've civil disobedience, we've had all kinds of campaigns. We won actually a 17-year injunction back in the mid to late 90s on logging, but it's back with a vengeance now. And you know, and the all of the issues that we won on in court, the basically the Forest Service went back and changed their manual, you know, so they no longer have to maintain for minimum viable populations of native vertebrate species, you know, and there's a number of different issues. It's much, much more difficult, a much higher bar to clear when it comes to protecting the natural world than we used to have to clear in the 90s and early 2000s. And so once we looked at our my colleagues and I looked at the Shawnee and all that it has to offer and how unique the area is. We already have 7 national natural landmarks located within in the Shawnee area. We decided that, which is something that is a recognition by the National Park Service, that it does warrant being a national park. And now that we have the information that we have on climate change and the important role that mature forests, even eastern deciduous forests like we have in the Shawnee, have on carbon sequestration and effective carbon storage, it just makes sense that following the guidelines of Dr. William Mumaugh, who came up with the concept of proforestation, of, you know, leaving forest ecosystems intact, a type of forestry that doesn't count on deforestation, reforestation, or afforestation, one that, you know, manages for keeping the forest intact. It just makes sense. And so we have currently 63 national parks in the country and 21 national preserves. And all of those are managed by the Park Service. Preserves, national preserves are areas with qualities very similar to those of a national park and equal national park status, but they allow for more flexibility, like hunting and trapping and gathering firewood and mushroom hunting and things like that, dispersed camping that you often can't do in national parks. And so what we're proposing is to have about, you know, probably about 10% of the Shawnee become a national park and 90% of it become this national preserve. And where those uses can continue that people have grown accustomed to on the national forest. But it would be a climate preserve, and the climate preserve part of it would basically restrict resource extraction. There wouldn't be resource extraction because there are some national preserves that do allow for resource extraction. Predominantly is oil and gas drilling. But we want to basically take out those carbon heavy carbon footprint type of activities to open the forest up to more recreational activities. And so that's where we're headed. And we think that the Shawnee is a perfect candidate. We think that we also need a system of climate preserves throughout the country. It is time that clearly the science is on our side here. You know, back, I have to remind people that back in the 1990s, we had we all rallied around a zero cut policy that I think even the Sierra Club was supportive on the national forest, on our public land. And, you know, but that was more political. It really wasn't based on the science that we really need to stop for the health of these ecosystems. And now for the health of our planet, for humanity in general, you know, an argument I'm used to making that we need to, you know, we need to act to protect humanity, but we do. And the Shawnee's not going to save the world from climate change, there's no question, but it might start a process just like the Ozark National Scenic Riverways Act did in 1964 in the Missouri Ozarks, when the first national scenic river was established. That became the blueprint for the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act that in 1968 passed. Now we have dozens of national rivers that are protected. You know, never before that act were free-flowing rivers protected. You know, the same happened with the establishment of Big Cypress National Preserve and the Big Thicket National Preserve in 1974. They were simultaneously put into law. And, you know, these were unique ecosystems with unique challenges. You know, without Big Cypress, there's a good chance the Florida Everglades would dry up, you know, because they protected this important flow of water through from Lake Okeechobee down into the Everglades ecosystem that people were just completely destroying at the time. You know, so this could start this process. And Illinois has absolutely no national parks currently, and if we're going to really address climate change, we have to basically try to adapt some of our transportation means. And anyone that has been to a popular national park in the last couple of years knows how overcrowded our parks are. And people drive and fly and travel great distances to go to national parks. Maybe they'd travel a little less distance and come to the Shawnee National Park and contribute a little less carbon into the atmosphere in doing that. And it's just, I think it's just the beginning of something that we could start, because we have it's well known, it's well documented that the best examples of old growth and mature forests are found on national forest land that we have in this country. What are we doing cutting them down? You know, that we it's they do this incredible thing, help reduce climate change for free. It just doesn't make sense that we should also be putting energies, monies, and resources into cutting them down. So hopefully this will start a trend, and we can get the Shawnee is close to like a 7-hour drive from millions of Americans, you know, from Chicago to St. Louis, Memphis, Nashville. You know, it's really a relatively short drive that people can come to the Shawnee and visit the Shawnee and hopefully reduce some of their carbon footprint while going on vacation.
So we have just a couple minutes left. I have two questions. One of them is, can you talk about the process by which this park would be put in place and how people can help? And then I'll ask the other question. So very, very quickly, what is the process and how can people help?
So this will take an act of Congress. And in order to do that, we have to convince Congress that this is something that people want. One of the things is to write their congressmen, write senators. We have petitions. We have an online petition that's available on our website at the ShawneeForestDefense.org that you can sign the petition. We have sample letters that you could send to either our senators or our politicians. We also ask people to join our Shawnee Park and Climate Alliance email list. Send us an email at Shawnee Park and Climate Alliance, @gmail.com, and we'll put you on our list. We'll send you some different talking points and to get involved, from that aspect as well. Any type of correspondence with our lawmakers to get this ball rolling a little bit. One of the things you can even contact, if you're not from Illinois, you can contact our lawmakers and tell people that you would come to Illinois to visit the new Shawnee National Park. And that has a great influence on our lawmakers, because we used to have a coal industry here. Illinois is known for its high sulfur coal. Well, that is dried up. Fortunately, I mean, it needs to. So there's no longer operating coal mines. We really don't have any manufacturing to speak of anymore. And tourism has become the one industry that is sustainable, it seems. You know, the small tourism base, we have a lot of wineries, we have some breweries, different restaurants, different unique shops, things like that, cabin rentals. Those kind of things have really blossomed, and they've really started when logging was outlawed, when we had that injunction. We need to have some sort of economic stabilization to be able to protect. You know, it's not where my wheelhouse of interest is. You know, in providing jobs and for locals, but if we don't have something to stabilize our economy and something that is sustainable, another extractive industry will move in. You know, the oil and gas industry has not even started in the Shawnee, but with fracking, we suspect it's coming. Much less the logging industry is starting to ramp up, and I think we're much better off having an economy that's based on on keeping our ecosystems intact instead of one that's hell bent on destroying them.
Do you have a website people can go to?
Yes, ShawneeForestDefense.org, and just Google Shawnee Park and Climate Alliance, and it's the Shawnee National Park and Preserve. There's two different websites, but if you Google Shawnee Park and Climate Alliance, you can get to that website.
So thank you for that. And my very last question is, I have in my life very rarely seen a migration of salamanders or of other amphibians. And you've talked about that road being closed. So is it just like an occasional snake going by, or is it actually sort of awe-inspiring? And if it's not particularly exciting, then close with one other exciting story about just some ecological thing in the region.
You know, I can't tell you how many times I have in the early spring, late winter, I've turned down a gravel road and just had to stop because after dark, because of all of the frogs that were migrating across the road. And that's not the snake road. But to time it is challenging because it's all based on temperatures, basic moisture and temperatures. And, you know, if it's a dry spring, it'll be different than if it's a wet spring. And if it's a cool spring, you know, you can't judge it. I would, and I have, generally speaking, salamanders are not, when they're moving, they're usually under the leaf litter moving. Every now and then they'll cross, you know, cross a road and that sort of thing, but more because they dry out so quickly and they don't move as quickly as a frog can. You know, a frog can jump across a 20-foot wide gravel road in three leaps. You know, a salamander is pretty slow to get across an area like that. But when you start to see them out, you know, if you move some leaves and it is amazing some of the different, and 2 weeks later you won't find a single one. I have seen a zigzag salamander. You know, you find one and you find 20, but after that you can't find them to save your life. You know, they're just, it's a timing kind of thing. The snakes, on the other hand, if it's the right sunny day, and see, especially in the spring, it's more profound in the spring, and it's 60 days. It starts on March 15th when they close this road. But a good sunny day after a cool night, you know, probably in the 40s, something like that, where it's getting up into the 60s during the day and it's sunny, those snakes will just make it out of those rocks and just get onto that road and they bask in it. You know, so they're not actively, as a rule, they're not moving much because they need that sun to warm up. You know, that's really what they're hoping to, you know, to get their body temperature increased a little bit so they can move better and more effectively. But when, if you catch the right day and the right conditions, it's crazy. I mean, you can see, you know, 30, 40 snakes on the road. You come from, you're my age, Derek, and you remember the Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom with I'm trying to think of the gentleman's name, but
Marlon Perkins.
See, he was the curator of the St. Louis Zoo for a long time, and he came to to Snake Road to collect snakes. You know, that he came down to Southern Illinois because of all of the different snakes that we had. You know, I'm sure he had Jack do all the snake wrangling, you know, if you recall. He always had this poor guy do all the dangerous stuff while he just told you what he was doing. But at any rate, it really is and can be awe-inspiring. And, you know, and then you lump that in with the wildflowers blooming or the songbird migration. Oh, my gosh. You know, it's you catch it on a certain day when the weather's just right. It's as if birds are just falling out of the sky everywhere, you know, and singing and showing themselves. So it can be very awe-inspiring.
Well, thank you so much for all of this. And thank you for your work in the world. And thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been John B. Wallace. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.